We're doing Parshas Vayeshev. We had seen how the brothers went out to shepherd the sheep. They went out to Shechem. Yosef came out to check on them, and they're ready to kill him. They think he's trying to do them in. And Reuven wants to save him. He says, let's not physically murder him. Let's put him here in the pit. No one will hear him. No one will think of him. And we won't do first degree. And his real intentions are to come at night. Where we left off was that had Yehuda known that the Tanakh would have recorded what he did to save Yosef, he would have taken him on his shoulders and brought him home. And we said that sometimes that's a tool we should use in life if we think about the credit we'd get and the applaud we'd get for doing what's right. Sometimes that gives us the encouragement to actually do it. So Yosef comes to the brothers. And they take off that special garment, the ketonet hapasim, and they throw him in the pit. And they sit down to eat bread, which can be understood in two directions. You could understand it as the Torah's illustrating an extraordinary level of cruelty. You know, there he is in the pit, crying, calling, and they sit down to eat. And that would be the simple reading of the verse, that they throw him in the pit and they sit down to eat. There's an alternate understanding here. We have a halacha that a court cannot eat for the remainder of a day after they declared someone should get the death penalty. Meaning, after a court administers the death penalty, they must fast the remainder of the day. And we find in the end of the book of Judges, when the brothers went to war, when we had civil war, so even though the tribes were victorious against Benjamin, they at the end of a war, they sat down and wouldn't eat the rest of the day. When they contemplated what it meant to attack a tribe of Israel, to kill their own brethren, even though the law was on their side, and you see, God was on their side, they wouldn't eat the remainder of the day. So here, the brothers are sitting down to eat. That's an indication of how confident they were that Yosef is a low-life bum, and that they're ridding the world of another Esav, that the world is a better place now that Yosef's in the pit. Technically, he's not yet dead either, but they didn't have any qualms. Their issue was, Dad doesn't realize what Yosef is really all about, but we're doing what's right. And then they look up, and they see a caravan of Yishmaelites coming from the city of Gilad. We discussed Gilad is an exceptional place, a place filled with murderers. So the Yishmaelim, you have descendants of Yishmael coming to carry spices or wax or perfume down to Egypt. And Yehuda tells the brothers, we're not going to make any money if we just kill him like this. Let's sell him to the Yishmaelites. He is our brother. And the brothers accept it. Now, part of the idea is there's been a decree that Israel will be enslaved for 400 years. So he's the big bum. Let him pay out that decree. Let's send him down to Egypt. He thinks he's going to rule over all of us. Okay, let's see what happens now. You know, an eye for an eye. If he thinks he's going to put all of us down, so it's only fitting that we should put him down. Now, in Tanakh, we often find that the actions we do as we try to fight our destiny, very often they support our destiny. The brothers will propel Yosef into the throne, you know, by throwing him down to Egypt. That's actually sending him to the position of leadership. So then the Torah describes how Midianites passed by and they pulled him out of the pit and they sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 coins. And here it's not clear from the verse who pulled Yosef out of the pit. Did the brothers pull Yosef out of the pit? What happened? Where did these Midianites come from? In the book of Judges, we find that the Yishmaelim are also called Midianites. So Avram Avinu had one son named Yishmael, and he had another son named Midian. One of Avram's children was Midian. Ve'ifa, ve'efer, v'achyanoch, v'avida, ve'elda'a, kol eile b'nei Keturah. From his last wife, Keturah, he had many children, one of which was named Midian. So some want to say that the name Yishmaeli is encompassing for all of Avram's descendants, other than Yitzchak, right? Yosef Avraham, Veikach Isha, Ushma Keturah. The simple reading is that she was his wife. Either this was the same Hagar, and he just strengthened their marriage, they renewed their wedding vows, or strengthened their wedding vows by making it a full-fledged marriage, or it was a new wife. So, the simple reading again is that the Midianites sold him down to Egypt. And Reuven comes, and Yosef's not there. And he comes to the brothers and say, he's gone. What do we do now? So then, according to that, they didn't sell him. According to that reading of the verse, and if you read the verse simply, that's what it says. They thought to sell him to the Ishmaelites. And then Midianites passed. And they pulled him out of the pit. And they sold him to the Ishmaelites. And then the Ishmaelites brought him down to Egypt. We have different opinions among the commentaries what actually happened here. But the simple reading of the prophet, the prophecy we will read in the Haftarah this week, is that the Navi describes, Al Shelosha Pishei Yisrael Val Arba Lo Ashivenu. There's one sin which I'm just not going to forgo, God says, Al Micham Bakesef Tzadik Vevion Bavur Nalaim, because Israel sold their poor brother for a pair of shoes. Each of the brothers got a pair of shoes out of this sale. So the simple reading of the prophet is that they did sell their brother. And that's a stain on our history from then onward. You see, almost a millennium later, the prophet is still rebuking us over that. Okay?
What's the significance of shoes? Does it mean that they were no longer like walking on holy ground? Like, were they before wearing shoes?
Yeah. These were new pairs of shoes.
Where did they get shoes? Yeah. Did they trample Joseph?
Let's wait. Maybe later tonight we'll come back to the significance of a shoe in Tanakh. Okay? I'll just give you food for thought. The shoe is often a reference to the body for the soul. Just like the body stands in the shoe, so too the soul stands in the body. And so very often when we speak about taking off a shoe and putting on a shoe, we're referring to an idea of providing a body for a soul, providing a representation for a soul in the world. Okay, so that's just food for thought, that shoes have a very big significance in Tanakh.
The mitzvah of chalitza.
Oh, right. Why does she take off her brother-in-law's shoe? She's saying, you're not giving your brother's soul a representation with the body in this world, so remove your shoe. And they felt, if we've already gone this whole finish, that they're finally getting representation in the world. So long as Yosef was around, their representation was threatened. Now that Yosef's gone, so they can actually do what they're supposed to do in the world. So they get their shoes. Okay, that also needs to be discussed, right? So our story begins with their tearing Yosef's garment, and it ends with Reuven tearing his own garment. Tears his garment, comes to the brothers and say, the kid's gone. What do I do now? Interesting that Yosef's a kid. He's 17. Why did they get such a poor price on Yosef? Because he was so pale. He was so scared. So he wasn't worth much on the slave market. So they take his garment. They slaughter a goat. They dip his garment in blood. And they send it to their father. And they say, this is what we found. Do you recognize it? Is it your son's garment or not? Very interesting, because when you read this, it sounds so cruel, the way they speak about Yosef. is it your son, not our brother, is it your son's garment? But if you look in the Medrash describes that when Yosef was ratting on the brothers, he used to say, this is what your sons did. He didn't say, this is what my brothers did. He used to say, this is what your sons did.
Wow.
Definitely seems to be an indication there that this wording, like, he's not looking at them as brothers, they're not looking at him as a brother. It's all great. We happen to share a father, but we're not connected. The word ach, brother, in Hebrew, connotes connection. Ichui means to connect. So they don't call him ach. They call him your son. And Yaakov recognizes it, and he says, it is the garment of my son. A wicked animal devoured him. A wicked animal? Yeah. Animals could be wicked. A lion is wicked because he devours a human. Or was he alluding to the thought that maybe it's one of his brothers? When he says a wicked animal, he is telling them, I'm not so sure who killed Yosef. And that's why...
Or if he's killed it all.
He tears his garments. He starts mourning. And everyone tries to comfort him. And he refuses. He says, no, I will weep this to my death. Now that doesn't work, because in Judaism you're not allowed to weep over something till your death. It doesn't work that way. We have 7 days of mourning, we have 30 days of mourning. For a parent, there's a year of mourning, but then you have to get up. So what's Yaakov doing? And the Medrash says that Yaakov was told by God that if he loses a child in his lifetime, then he knows that he's done for. Then there's no... That's a sign for him that he has not lived up to his responsibilities in the world. If he's lived up to his responsibilities, then the 12 sons represent 12 forces in the Jewish people, and they are to become the Jewish people. So when Yaakov sees that Yosef's gone, the difference between Yaakov's vantage point and the brother's vantage point, a pivotal difference, is that Yaakov saw 12 forces and 12 children. Each one was going to represent a different strength within Israel. And to Yaakov's mind, if one is gone, then everyone's gone. Then our destiny as the Jewish people is gone. Then that means I messed up horribly. And it's not hard for Yaakov to think that, because he's lived a more difficult life than any of his predecessors. No one else had to work as hard as he for 14 years for a father-in-law who was a swindler and trying to rob him blind. No one else had a situation where they found their children with idols like Yaakov did after they left Shechem. No one else had an issue where his children were going and killing a whole town against his will. So it's true, Avram had a Yishmael and Yitzchak had an Esav, but they weren't part of the chosen people. Yaakov's 12 sons are supposed to be the chosen people. And now he has to deal with this. And now finally the straw that breaks the camel's back. Yosef's missing and he's not sure who did it. So when he's mourning Yosef, he's not only mourning Yosef, he's mourning the idea that his job in the world has become a failure. He has failed at his task, because if Yosef's dead, that means the Jewish people are not coming through him. Something's wrong here. And God's not talking to him. God's not talking to him, as we've noticed throughout the book of Bereishis. One of the major themes is the silence. Even the patriarchs have to live with silence. They have questions and God doesn't come down and say, hey, it's all going to be all right. Don't worry, Yaakov. Everything's okay. No. Yaakov has to live with the fact that he has no idea.
Hashem was sworn to silence by his brothers, some of that I heard.
Okay, there is such a medrash. The simple understanding is that prophecy can only settle on a person when they're happy. And Yaakov was very sad. Happiness was the last thing on his mind. So Yosef is taken down to Egypt. Very pretty looking young man, 17 years old. The Egyptians are into all kinds of unusual activities, women sleeping with women, men sleeping with men. And so Potiphar, who was the chief executioner of Pharaoh's, he buys Yosef, and his intent is that Yosef will serve him and he will sleep with Yosef. And our tradition is that Potiphar bought him for that purpose alone. And God caused Potiphar to become castrated. So Potiphar becomes a eunuch. The Talmud says along came the angel Gabriel and castrated him, which could mean that as he was taking Yosef from the slave market to bring him home, Pharaoh said, I have a new position for you. You're going to be in charge of my house, and no one can enter my house unless they're a eunuch, so we're going to take care of you so you could have this honorable position. Because it's very strange, he's a eunuch, he's one of Pharaoh's eunuchs, but he has a wife. Why would he have a wife if he's a eunuch? So our tradition is that he wasn't always a eunuch. When he bought Yosef, so that he had one thought, and God said, no you don't, and God caused him to be a eunuch. How exactly that transpired, so that the Talmud says a very fascinating line. Gabriel came down and sliced him. Said, no you don't. The question is, is that to be taken literally? And now we have a pause in the story. An unlikely pause. Suddenly the Torah stops and takes us back to Israel. Put a pause on this story. Let's go back and hear what's going on. Yes?
So why Potiphar's wife wanted to seduce him? Because she didn't have...
Oh, right. That helps explain why Potiphar's wife is so interested in Yosef, yeah. So, the pasuk describes that Yehuda was demoted. All the brothers, upon seeing the grave reaction by Yaakov, they say, you were the leader. You were the one who told us to sell him. You could have told us to bring him home. We would have listened. And this is a phenomenal point for leadership, because the brothers could have looked at Yehuda and said, thanks to you, he's not dead. They don't do that. They say, you could have done better. You messed up. We all messed up, but you were the leader. So you're not the leader. But they're not going down to fetch Yosef from Egypt, because they don't yet have real regrets. They feel bad about the outcome of their actions. And had they known the outcome, they wouldn't have done it. But they're not so confident that they're wrong. It's going to take them 20 years to realize they were wrong. At this point, they're still convinced they're right. Yes?
They knew he was in Egypt?
The simple reading is that they did. Again, some commentaries learn that they were not the ones who sold him.
So the other thing that's interesting about that is that when they first come back down to Egypt to get the grain and the supplies and everything, they don't even attempt to meet Yosef.
Let's wait and see.
Okay.
Let's wait and see. Chazal tell us they did. Yeah. That's part of what got them into trouble. We'll see. So, Yehuda is demoted, and he goes and does business, and he marries a woman, we don't know her name, and he has a first son, second son, third son, and when his first son comes of age, he's ready to get married, he's 7 years old, so Yehuda goes looking for a wife, and Er is super intelligent. He's got the intelligence of a 20-year-old plus, even though he's only seven. That's what we'll see right now. So Yehuda goes to this sagacious woman named Tamar, a descendant of Shem, an extraordinarily pious woman, and he brings her for Er as a wife. Now, Tamar is not only pious, she's also extraordinarily beautiful. Now, she wants to marry into Yaakov's family, into Yehuda's family. But Er doesn't want her to lose her beauty. So Er spills his seed. He doesn't allow her to become pregnant. He ensures that his seed doesn't enter her. Different opinions among Chazal what he did. But however he ensured that would happen, he didn't let her get pregnant. And so he dies. Very interesting. People take birth control very easily today. It's, you see here, it's not so simple. You know, this is pre-Torah. Huh?
Was his daughter-in-law. I thought Tamar was his daughter-in-law.
Well, she was Yehuda's daughter-in-law. She married Er.
Okay,
right?
Okay.
So Er dies.
Okay.
Yehuda doesn't know why his firstborn son died. Young kid, he died at 7 years old. Seems strange. So he calls in his second son, who's six and a half, and he says, come, marry your sister-in-law so that your brother will have a representation in the world. You'll have kids. Now, Onan says, hey, if I have kids, they're all going to be attributed to him from his wife. I don't want to have kids that will be attributed to him. So he does the same thing. He spills his seed. He doesn't know it's what his big brother did. He also ensures she doesn't become pregnant for a different reason. And again, God has him die. Now, the Talmud says this is extraordinary. The Talmud says in their days, women and men couldn't become pregnant or be impregnated or impregnate a woman at age seven. But the Talmud says things changed. In the days of the Tanakh, they were capable. So the Yehuda's sons are extraordinarily brilliant, and they're capable, and so they are held accountable, and they die. So Yehuda's getting concerned. Hey, two sons, both dying. So he tells Tamar, look, why don't you wait a bit? Now we have a rule in Halacha. In order to validate something, in order to have a chazakah, you need three times. After an ox is gored three times, you know it's a goring ox. After something happened three times, you have a chazakah. But there are two opinions in Talmud, whether it takes two for a chazakah or three. So halachically, what we say is, with regards to matters that are life-threatening, after two we're worried. Meaning they offer you a shidduch. They tell you, why don't you marry so-and-so? And you know she has one brother, she has two brothers who died young. And no one's telling you why. So the halacha says, be careful. It hasn't yet been proven. Try to verify what's going on. If you can't verify, after you see something showing up in a family twice, you should be careful. If a woman has children, and her first son is circumcised at 8 days old and dies, so you don't say, ooh, there's something wrong with the family. You check him medically. Everything seems fine. The next son, you circumcise him at 8 days old. If he dies, then you say, we're not waiting till the third time to validate there's a problem with the family. After two, we no longer circumcise at 8 days in this family. After one, you don't know. You know, kids die from all kinds of things. After two, that's enough. So when it comes to issues that involve danger, we say that two is enough for a chazakah. So Yehuda looks, two sons drop dead. He says, I'm not marrying off the third one. He says, Tamar, why don't you wait a bit? Okay, so Tamar goes and waits, and she sees that Shelah, the final son, also came of age. He's 7 years old, and she's not being introduced. So she realizes that this was Yehuda's way of saying, no, it ain't happening. So Tamar hears that Yehuda, he lost his wife, and he's going up to celebrate to shear his sheep. So in those days, a widow used to be dressed in black. Tamar changes from her black clothing. She wears a shawl. She dresses herself with all kinds of clothing and scarves. And she waits for Yehuda to pass. She's waiting. And Yehuda comes by, and she's all covered. And he tells her, lady, would you be interested in us two going off together? He doesn't know it's Tamar. Now, firstly, that shows us how modest both of them were. The simple reading of the verse would be that she kept her face covered, that women of ill repute in those days kept their face covered because sometimes they'd be hired by their own relatives or other people. They'd be embarrassed if they knew who they were. So it was a common practice in those days that women of ill repute kept their face covered and the men never knew who she was, and that was irrelevant to everyone, and you just ignored that. That's the simple reading of the verse. Our tradition is different, that Yehuda and Tamar were extraordinarily modest so long as they were father-in-law and daughter-in-law, and being that she was so modest in his house, so he didn't know what she looked like. So when it came time, he didn't know it was her. Now, you read the story, and what's going on? So, if we want to better understand this, we should read a Rambam. Okay, they don't have that volume here. The Rambam, when he discusses marriage, so the Rambam says, Kotem Matan Torah, famous Rambam in the beginning of the laws of marriage, he says, before the Torah was given, a man could be walking down the marketplace, and a woman could be walking down the marketplace. They'd bump into one another, say, excuse me. They'd bump into one another, and that was a joke. Yes. They'd bump into one another, and if he wanted and she wanted, they could go off and live together as husband and wife. And then if they wanted to break up, then they could break up. Along came the Torah and says, no, there has to be a marriage contract. There's a way of getting married to a woman, etc. But the Rambam begins by giving us a perspective of how the world ran before the Torah was given. So before the Torah was given, it was perfectly legitimate for a man and a woman to decide we're going off together. The issue here is that they're going off together for few minutes, and then he's going his merry way, and she's going her merry way. Not what we would think is the holiest behavior. So, I'm tempted to leave it as a question. Okay, we'll mention one thing. The Talmud says, and there's a Medrash that discusses, maybe this is the source for Cupid, yeah? The Medrash discusses that God sent an angel and said, don't let Yehuda keep walking. Yehuda has to meet up with Tamar. This has to happen. If we really want a better understanding of this, so there's a concept quoted, if I'm not mistaken, by the Ben Ish Chai. He says as follows, if you want to see where the Davidic dynasty, where Mashiach came from, it's always shrouded in behavior that's questionable. You begin with Lot and his daughters. Wow. Okay, incest, right? No, technically, halachically, it was permissible because they thought there was no world left. So if they think there's no future to the world, if they don't do this, okay, so Adam and Eve and their kids also, you know, lived with their sisters, etc., until the world gets going. But it's a pretty disgusting way to start the world. Okay, you continue your story. You come down to Yehuda and Tamar. He doesn't even know it's his daughter-in-law. Okay, she's not his daughter-in-law. But he thinks it's a woman of ill repute. Not exactly the most pious of relationships, you would think. You continue to Ruth and Boaz. Again, the whole connection between them comes out of, first, Ruth is married as a non-Jew to Boaz's cousin or nephew or whatever. And then she sneaks up on him in the middle of the night. And then finally you have a marriage. Join us before Shavuos. And then there's a whole story about Yishai and his wife. He didn't even know it was her in bed. He thought it was someone else. A whole complicated story going on there. So you see generation after generation until you come to David. So the Ben Ish Chai says that when you have something really, really good that has to come to the world, so it's as though God says, I can't bring it through the front door. There's going to be too much protest in heaven from the powers, so to speak, call it the forces of evil, call it the Yetzer Hara, the Satan. It's as though God says, let me give him his portion and then let me move forward with the show. If I want something really good, I have to bring it out of something that's really questionable. And this concept can be interpreted in many ways. So the Kabbalists will say, oh, there are two forces in the world. There's good, there's bad. And you have to placate the bad in order to make a lot of good. Whatever, I don't understand what any of that means. But there are other ways of understanding this. And one way is the Talmud says that ordinarily, Talmidei Chachamim do not have children who are Talmidei Chachamim. God makes it that it's very hard for a Talmud Chacham's son to actually be learned in Torah. So that people wouldn't think you have to have a father who's a rabbi in order to become a rabbi. So rabbis' children ordinarily do not come out as rabbis. God makes it much harder for them. They can become rabbis, but they'll have to work much harder than the next guy. You'd think it's easier. No, it's harder. So it seems that there's this concept in heaven that good shouldn't just come from good. Ruth has to come from the Moabites. The most cruel of nations has to develop the Davidic dynasty, who's all about giving. It has to come from somewhere. And even David and Bathsheba, right? The whole Davidic dynasty comes from David and what would seem like rape of a girl who's seven. That certainly doesn't seem too pious, right? And from there comes the Davidic dynasty, and God says, yeah, Yedidya. That child from that union, he's my friend. God names him Yedidya. So again, you look at the whole lineage and it looks weird. So Chazal say that God doesn't want someone going into public office unless they have a bag of vermin draped over their back. Unless they have, the Talmud calls it a kupa shel shratzim. If they have a bag of vermin over their back, then they can succeed. The Talmud says, why was King David successful where King Saul failed? Because King Saul came from an excellent family, and when he erred in life, he had a hard time seeing that he erred. When King David was rebuked, he was used to being scolded. He was used to a life where he always had to say, well, I'm sorry, it's not exactly... They tell him, who are you? Are you a kosher Jew? David, you come from Ruth. We're not sure we can even marry you. They talk to him and say, you know, we're not sure if you're a bastard. No one knows where your mother got pregnant from. So he had to live life in this slight apologetic form, and that developed a better leader. Chazal say the better leaders come from a dark history. You see someone with a great family lineage and everything, he's not necessarily the best choice for a leader. The best leaders are if they have a kupat shatzim, they have a bag of vermin behind them. So perhaps that's part of the idea that the Davidic dynasty has to come with a lot of vermin in their bag. Yeah, it's going to be the greatest dynasty of the Jewish people. You have to see where it comes from. And we could understand this on another level as well. Let's take Machon Meir. Okay? A guy walks into Machon Meir and he says, what chance do I have of greatness? You know, I see kids here who know Rashi better than me. So what chance do I have? So every year we read at the Seder and we tell our kids, Arami Oved Avi. Mitchila Ovdei Avodah Zarah Hayu Avoteinu. We're all descendants of pagans. Let's not kid ourselves. We're sitting here at a Seder table. We're celebrating that we're the chosen people. So we remind our children, part of the story we tell them every year is, remember you have humble beginnings. Remember your great-great-granddad was a pagan. He was bowing. At my Seder table, I do this. I take a bottle of grape juice, I put it in front of me, and I say, kids, now watch. This is what Grandpa did. Okay? He'd stand there and say, please help me, save me. He'd pray to a bottle. He'd pray, and I stand there, and I do a whole act for 5 minutes about the cherished bottle. Help me out, save me. They should understand, yeah, this is where we came from. And they look at me and they say, you want to tell me our grandfather was so stupid? Yeah, what am I supposed to say? But it's a lesson for us. And it gives us an important vantage point on where we can get to. One of the great lessons we learn from Yehuda and we learn from David is that when they failed, they got up and said, I was wrong, and now I'm going to build from here onward. Remember the famous allegory we gave about the kid who dirties the floor and he comes and sweeps it up, right? Many people will dirty the floor. The greatness of Yehuda and David is that they say, I did it, I'm coming back to clean it up. The fact that we mess up, yeah, we mess up. So you can approach the story the classical way that Chazal tell us that God wanted the Davidic dynasty to come from to the world through Tamar, who was so pious, and through Yehuda. And Yehuda wasn't about to do it on his own, and so God had him overtaken with desire, and so this is how the story played itself out. You could look at it the other ways we suggested. Okay, you have in Chazal different approaches, and we gave a few. Okay, so this vantage point, that vantage point, just be prepared that when you say one, you'll get some people upset. When you say the other, you'll get some people upset. Say that, but in Chazal, we find more than one. So, in heaven, they're ensuring that Yehuda and Tamar meet, and again, quoting the Rambam, we understand that what they did wasn't technically wrong. It's just a question of, it doesn't look nice. You know, it's not what you'd expect from Yehuda. We could elaborate on this point, but I think we have directions to approach the parsha. That's enough for now. Unless someone here is really bothered with the story, then we can elaborate. No. Okay, so let's continue. So, this is very strange. She asks him for proof that he'll pay. Collateral. And she says, I want your signet ring, I want your cape, I want your staff. Yehuda's staff? Who? He gives it to her.
He thought that was a pretty big ask, you know?
Yeah. Well, he assumed he's getting it back. What's she going to do with his staff? But he's giving her identifying markers, not what you'd expect. So she goes, and finished, Yehuda sends his buddy. He doesn't want to show up there, right? Bad enough he did it once. He's not going to show up a second time, which also shows us a level of piety. Because, you know, the average guy who went to a woman of ill repute once is going to want to go a second time. Yehuda, not only doesn't he go the second time, he doesn't even go to pay. He sends his buddy, you know, the non-Jew. Worst comes to it, if he'll want to sleep with her, you know, that for him it's not the end of the world. But for Yehuda, bad enough he fell once. So he sends his buddy, and his buddy doesn't find her. Now, this is what Yehuda was worried about. Now he's going to have to go knocking on doors, you know. Did you see this lady around here? So his buddy, he doesn't mind, you know. This is what everyone around here is doing. So the buddy really knocks on the doors and starts asking, hey, you guys know where this woman's been? And people tell him, no, there isn't such a woman around here. So he comes back to Yehuda, and Yehuda says, okay, let's keep it quiet, you know. We don't need more shame. So here you see, there was a shame involved, right? So Yehuda says, I did what I could. You know, we agreed I'd send someone, I'd send the money. She's not there. And we'll have to pick up here, Bezachim, after Alvitz.